I'm really excited and slightly anxious to announce that my book, The Autistic Burnout Workbook, is releasing this next week. It comes out March 11th. It's available for pre-order right now. I am trying to avoid falling back into burnout. When you release a book, there is a lot of pressure to do promotion and to market and to get the word out there. So this is my burnout prevention form of marketing. I'm running a special right now for those who are supporting my work through pre-ordering. You can submit that information after you pre-order, and we will get you a coupon code that you can use toward our store for the same amount. So the workbook costs $18.99. So then you'd get $18.99 to use in our digital shop or in our Etsy shop, which would get you another digital workbook for free. So you buy one workbook and then you get a digital one for free. That is the promotion I'm running. It's technically a pre-order promotion, but I've been a bit behind on getting the word out. So for listeners of the podcast, I'm going to extend that. If you buy the book in the next month, you can go ahead and redeem the special. The link for that is in the notes below. Thank you so much for supporting my work. It means so much to me, and I just really appreciate you and hope that you will find this a helpful resource for you as you continue to build a life that is a bit more resilient to autistic burnout.
Hey, everyone. You are listening to the Divergent Conversations podcast. We are two neurodivergent mental health professionals in a neurotypical world. I'm Patrick Cassell.
And I'm Dr. Neff.
And during these episodes, we do talk about sensitive subjects, mental health, and there are some conversations that can certainly feel a bit overwhelming. So we do just want to use that disclosure and disclaimer before jumping in. And thanks for listening. Okay, so welcome back to another episode of Divergent Conversations podcast. Megan and I haven't recorded in a couple of weeks because I've been traveling. We are back. I am sick. Megan has brain fog. Story of our lives.
This will be an interesting episode.
This will be an interesting episode. So we were bouncing around the ideas of talking about attachment theory and neurodivergence and potentially even dipping our toe into the water of just discussing partnerships and within our own neurotypes and our own relationships. So where do you want to start?
Yeah, those are big topics. I think attachment theory would provide the structure to then talk about partnerships. So attachment theory?
Yeah. So Megan may or may not give the bird's eye view on attachment theory. And we don't want to go too far into the clinical realm of that, but we do like to set the stage. So if you have something you want to share or kind of
foundation. Yeah. Before recording, I was saying like, I like doing that bird's eye view, but also brain fog. It would be easier if I had a transcript. And I think some of this theory will naturally interweave as we talk. But bird eye view goes back to like the 60s, John Bowlby and Mary Ainsworth. And initially it comes from kind of parent-child interactions and that they noticed some distinct patterns of how infants responded when it's called the strains situation is kind of the big study that's often cited. And how infants responded, typically mom, again, talking about 1960, so there's a lot of gendering, and it was typically mom and baby who went into the study and into a room, and then mom would leave and come back. And they were gauging, like, how does the infant respond? For securely attached infants, mom was like a kind of safe haven, a secure base, that's what they called. And so because mom was there, the child felt more free to go and play with the toys and to explore and even, and there's another person in the room. With more anxiously attached children, they protested when mom left and then had a really hard time being soothed by mom. Again, typically mom, care provider, primary attachment figure, we'll say that. When primary attachment figure came back, would have difficulty being soothed by them. With a securely attached, they'd still protest, but they could be soothed by the by the caretaker when they come back. And then with avoidant, kind of didn't protest as much when caretaker left, and wasn't as easily self-soothed. But then what they noticed is like heart rate still went up. So stress markers still went up. Okay, that's my brain fog version of the strange situation. Where the research got, I think, even more interesting is when they started realizing that attachment style continues and started looking at adult attachment style. And then that shows up in romantic partnerships. And I think that's probably where we'll talk more about today. But it gets pretty interesting when we start looking at attachment theory and neurodivergence. Like some of the questions that come to my mind is, does this theory and framework fit for us? It's one of the questions I have. The research shows ADHD and autistic people tend to be more insecurely attached than neurotypical people, which makes sense to me. But again, I wanted to be like, well, how much is that capturing our true attachment style? And how much is that capturing other traits that might make us look avoidant or look insecurely or anxiously attached? How was my brain fog version of attachment theory?
I think you did a wonderful job. So, you know, as Megan kind of said, attachment theory and is interwoven throughout not just childhood development, but throughout adolescent and young adult development too, certainly plays a role in both platonic and romantic relationships and how you kind of show up and how you feel safe, secure, connected to the people around you. And I think that gets really, there's some like stuff that's really interwoven here when we're talking about neurodivergence and neurodevelopment. And we're talking about like feeling safe, feeling secure, feeling like you're attached or connected to or safe with someone. Mm-hmm. And this goes far beyond just like that emotional feeling of safeness, right? Like there's also just the ability to be mentally safe and to be neurologically safe too. So this is a complicated conversation.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And I think, so one of the interesting things about attachment theory is the idea the first year, your attachment to your primary caregiver becomes kind of like a blueprint, that becomes your template. And you tend to continue to attach that way. And it can vary, of course. And people can, it's called earned security when you earn a secure attachment. But this is where I think cross neurotype gets really interesting. Like if you've got a primary caregiver and an infant who are cross neurotype, typically you're not going to know that in the first year. And what might be attunement to one neurotype, right? So like eye contact, holding, touch, right? What might be attunement for, say, a neurotypical infant might be dysregulating and intrusive for an autistic infant. So I think that's pretty interesting when we start thinking about early development and cross neurotype and attunement, because that attunement is what's so important for that secure attachment to take root.
Yeah, and that attunement can so easily be missed or misidentified or misclassified, especially when we're talking about infancy and, you know, any sort of development where the child is not able to actually communicate their needs or have their needs met. And then it can also play a role for that caregiver too, if it's really challenging to have that connection with the child as well.
Absolutely. And then the caregiver like might be really confused because things they've learned is like, this is supposed to be soothing for my child, but it's not. And then that, depending on that caregiver's role, like that can activate their own attachment stuff. It gets, I think, really complex. And yeah.
Go ahead.
I was going to take it to our experience because I know we've both talked about like, yeah, we're avoidant.
Oh, for sure. I mean, when I started learning about attachment theory, I was like, I think there was a part of me that was probably like, oh, I resonate with anxious attachment. And there's some anxiety of like that push-pull kind of mentality of like, I come closer, you back away versus, or vice versa. But then I realized more and more, like by doing my own work, avoidant style made a lot more sense. And you know, to all the folks who are well, you know, well-versed in attachment theory, a lot of folks that are labeled as avoid and attached get a bad rap. You know, because
yeah.
You're like, this person is self-soothing all the time. This person wants to do things on their own. They cut people off very quickly. They disconnect very quickly. They look for the littlest thing in relationship to kind of move away. Mm-hmm. It's really hard for me to create this like connection. It feels mm-hmm. one-sided. And I think that mm-hmm. is a challenging label sometimes for people to kind of be classified under when you start talking about all of the separate characteristics of attachment.
Yeah. Yeah. I would say both forms of insecure, both avoidant and anxious, get pretty bad raps of like anxious on the other side is like, oh, you're so needy, blah, blah, blah. Avoidant, like you don't care, you're cold. And I've heard it said that behind every avoidant attachment person is a very anxiously attached person, which I think that's an interesting idea to play with. But also, yeah, I mean, these things ebb and flow more than any attachment grid will show, right? Like, based on context and relationship and life. Yeah, so the thing I'm curious about, Patrick, for me is I've always, before I knew I was autistic, when I learned about attachment, I was like, okay, yeah, avoidant totally ticks the boxes. Now I'm wondering, like, okay, how much of that has to do, like, how much of that is true attachment stuff, like, from my early childhood and these things, and how much of that is autistic traits? Like, I don't like touch. Touch is really hard for me. I like to be alone. I get overwhelmed by people's emotions, positive or negative, so I retreat. A lot of that is due to my autistic neurology, more so than my attachment. So that's where I'm like, huh, it's hard to tease out what is my autistic needs and self-soothing versus what is like true attachment style.
Yeah, that's a great point. Like, how do we differentiate what is neurology? What's attachment system related? What is interwoven and connected? I think about this exercise I did. I was doing this like intensive 3-day somatic based attachment training several years ago, DARE training. I think it's dynamic attachment repatterning experience. And one of the workshops or the protocols that we were doing was like, all right, come into a room, walk towards the person sitting on the couch until you can tell that they no longer want you to walk any closer to them based on like eye contact, based on body language, based on posture. And that's like your window of attachment or tolerance. And I felt like mine was like so massive because I was like, I don't want to make any of this eye contact, you know, like, yeah. I don't want to have any of this connection in terms of you walking directly at me to like approach me in this way. So that's something that stands out to me in terms of like chicken before the egg situation, like where, how
totally.
Do we figure out which is which or which is both?
Yeah. Because like, yeah, same for me of people approaching me feels very intrusive. And yeah, I think probably both because that can then having those needs, and I would say like sensory needs, because a lot of being around people is a sensory experience, probably then shapes our attachment style. So yeah, I don't think it's an either or.
What about you for your experiences? You say you felt like, okay, you're on more of the avoidance style. But if we were to take that step back and say behind every avoidant is an anxiously secure or anxiously attached, do you have any examples of that for yourself?
Totally. I want to talk about this too. Like, so there's a study. I don't think it was peer reviewed, but it was really interesting. It's been a while since I looked at it, but it looked at like infatuation, kind of pre-dating, during dating, and maybe attachment or just connection between autistic and non-autistic people. And it showed autistic people tend to have higher infatuation like before dating, and then it decreases kind of more rapidly than neurotypical. So I was like, oh, that relates. In college, I had 3-month relationships, but I always, so there's this idea of like a person can become a special interest, right? And I've definitely had that experience. And I would say when a person becomes a special interest, that more anxious attachment stuff does show up, but it's complicated because part of
my attachment is to the fantasy of that person. And I would now say, okay, this is going to sound weird. The fantasy, oh gosh, this is one of the things that I'm like saying, and I'm like, I'm not sure I want to say. The fantasy of being non-autistic. Oh my gosh, I'm actually getting emotional. Because in the fantasy, when people become special interests, I can be close to them. And it's not intrusive. And I can feel connected in the way that like I long for. And that's really hard for me because being in a relationship, being close to people feels so intrusive. But in my fantasy, especially when people become special interests, I get to experience a non-intrusive intimacy.
Thank you for sharing that and just being willing to share that and be really vulnerable about it. Yeah, I can sense that emotion. I can feel that, and I can really take that in. That makes a lot of sense when you put it that way too, because it allows you to feel deeply connected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
So I like to just name that and put that out there.
I mean, I don't like emotion. I talk about that pretty regularly. I also think the most, what's the phrase? Like the most personal is the most global. I think perhaps even know based on conversations that there will be people that relate to that.
Absolutely.
For me, like I have talked about this in writing. This is the hardest part about being autistic is the way I put it in writing a couple years ago is like my soul longs for connection and my body longs for isolation. Mm. And that to me is the hardest part about being autistic.
Yeah. I can deeply relate with that.
Yeah, does my emotion bring up anything
for you? I'm
feeling
like protectiveness of you.
Mm. And,
you know, you hate physical touch. I hate physical touch, but it makes me want to like hug you, embrace you.
Mm.
But it's, I think you just said that perfectly too. Like the soul longs for connection and the body yearns for isolation. I think that is pretty spot on. And you know, I say that so often, like the autistic existence is a torturous one. I think that mm-hmm. is always my word that I seem to default mm-hmm. to. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why it's just that intense push-pull of, damn, I want to feel like connected, a part of, attuned mm-hmm. to, and damn, I need to get away as fast as possible because I am so uncomfortable physically.
Yeah. Yeah. Uncomfortable, dissociated, foggy. Like I want to, like I used to say that all the time. Like I just want to be in my experience. And what I didn't realize I was saying is like I'm dissociated and I'm not in this moment.
Yeah.
And particularly in like social, like the things that you're supposed to feel connected in, right? The big ceremonies and rituals and holiday gatherings. These are times you're in my like supposed to feel connected and around people, and these would be times that I'd feel the most disconnected.
Which, you know, in regards to what we're talking about, has further impact in terms of like your attachment system too, when mm-hmm. these big societal normed / like cultural norms for certain pockets of people, and you're supposed to be connected and feel joyous and celebrate and close mm-hmm. to and present, and all you can feel is dissociated or foggy or numb or just not present in any form. Mm-hmm. It makes you feel even further othered in those situations where it's like, see, I truly mm-hmm. really don't belong here.
Yeah. And then the like what's wrong with me narrative comes on of like what's wrong with me, like these people are in this experience, why can't I just be in it?
Yeah. It's weird timing that we're talking about this, considering like we're going into like some major holidays in the United States.
I think holidays is a hard season for a lot of us. I mean, for a lot of humans, but I think especially autistic people, there's, talk about clashing needs a lot, like in clashing values, like talk about clashing values. Like I want my kids to have memories with extended family over the holidays. I don't want to travel. I don't want to be in a room with more than 7 people. it's a hard time of year for a lot of folks.
Yeah, it's a hard time in so many different ways. And then bring in the neurodivergent component. And there's almost like anticipatory grief. Like we're recording, what's today? November 14th. I have no idea when this will air, probably after Thanksgiving here in the States. But it'll probably air before Christmas. And there is anticipatory grief, for me at least. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure for you in some ways too. You've mentioned about your kiddos and your husband. But like my wife wants to be around her family. She wants to go eat close and connected and all the things. And there's like this anticipatory grief for me where it's like I can't show up the way she would want me to in a lot of ways. And I also am like conserving energy for a month straight to be able to participate for 6 hours of my life, which will then therefore drain me for a week of it.
Yeah. I have so many visceral memories. We don't travel as much, but like when we did travel to see Luke's family, or even sometimes like extended time with my family, I would feel like I became someone else. Like I'd become a very irritable version of me. And I couldn't be present. I couldn't get into the experience. And I'd always do this preparation thing of like, okay, you're going to be yourself this time. I didn't have any other words than just like, I don't become myself. And I didn't understand what was happening. I just knew that anytime, especially if we traveled, like I became a version of myself I really didn't like. I'm not normally a very irritable person, but I certainly am when I have lost my routines and I'm traveling and I'm like all of the things. So I hear you when it's like the grief of I'm not going to be able to show up the way I want to for my wife's family. Like I feel that. And like for you, is that, I remember for me, I'd be like, okay, I just need to flip a switch. I can do it. Like, is there that kind of like belief you should be able to just flip a switch and show up the way you want?
Totally. I mean, and I think that can even be enforced sometimes, like, or reinforced through messaging that you receive. And I know like before maybe my wife and I really knew each other or like what I needed and what my system needed, and that it wasn't just being selfish or like I didn't want to participate, where it would almost be like a pep talk of like, you can show up for one day of your life. Like you can do that. And sometimes I would even have to say it out loud to myself, like give myself like this, man in the mirror speech where I look at myself and I'm like, yeah, you can do this. You can like handle 6 hours. You can manage this. You can make it through whatever the event is, not specifically just talking about her family, because that's not the truth of it. It's really any gathering. And then so often just, continuously having to rely on just either one, alcohol, or two, complete silence and isolation. And I would become also like irritable, short, 1 to 2 word answers when people are talking to me. People would label that as like antisocial, dismissive, rude, whatever labels we want to throw onto the that presentation. And that just further makes you feel disconnected. Because I think for me, and I don't know about for you, I then go into like this internal dialogue of like trying to force myself out of that reaction where it's like, reacting like this. This is not how you want to come across. Like it's all you have to do is like just respond for 2 sentences. And maybe that will break down this like internal barrier, but then you just default back to the same. And it feels harder and harder and harder to then like really show up in a way that you want to. I don't know if that makes sense.
It makes so much sense. And I relate to that so much. The like, okay, don't do it this way. Do it this. And like that becomes part of the stress, right? Of like this, again, this idea, I should be able to do something different here.
Yes.
Yeah. That to me, that is where like discovering autism has been really helpful, because I was genuinely just so confused and of course reverted to like I'm a bad person or no, it's like, okay, I understand that I'm in a part of my nervous system that is shut down and like that's what's happening to me right now. And it doesn't mean that I like feel awesome about the situation or the engagement, but I understand it, which is helpful.
I agree 100%. The understanding may not always be helpful in some ways, but it is helpful in other ways where it's like, at least you're no longer doing this like existential search for what the hell is happening here. And
yeah, you
just default to like, okay, this is happening. Doesn't make it any more awesome. Like the experience is still painful, but at least I understand why it's painful. I think that helps a little bit.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. I mean, I think, you know, I feel like I talk about this a lot here. I'm such a fan of like self-attunement through self-narration. Of like, if I can narrate what's happening, that is a form of like radical self-attunement. So I think that opens up the opportunity for self-compassion in those moments of like, okay, this is a hard moment versus like, I know for me, what it was before is what's wrong with me? Why can't I just get in it? Now it's like, okay, this is a hard moment. This is what's happening. It's a very different self experience in those moments.
So true. So true. We diverged mightily.
I mean, it's all
connected,
clustered around attachment and intimacy. And yeah, it's interesting. I'm not a dualist in the sense of like, I don't like to separate kind of mind body, you know, that kind of Descartes dualism that took hold and shaped much of Western history. But when it comes to this conversation, I actually find the dualistic lens a little bit helpful in the sense of like, there is this really very real split I experience of like what I long for and then what my body can handle.
Yeah.
And I do think that, of course, that's going to shape attachment then and attachment style.
Absolutely. I also think, you know, just on that, in this perspective too, it's like, for those of you listening and wondering, okay, am I just now forever labeled avoidant attached, insecure, anxious attached? You can actually be in different attachment styles with different people, different relationships, and those can evolve based on learning, healing, growth, introspection, understanding. So this is not a like black and white end all be all situation either.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's where like an ebb flow kind of hold on attachment theory, I think, is really helpful. Yeah, like there is an attachment quiz out there where it'll like map you out on quadrants, like both your parents, friends, and then romantic partners, kind of how you lean in those different relationships, which I think that's interesting. But yeah, the idea that like we can heal secure attachment, and I think it's going to look different for autistic people. Like I feel really securely attached to my spouse, my children. I would even say my parents. It doesn't look the same way. I have a ton of space. If you were looking at me, you might not say I am securely attached. You say avoidant, but I do think I am securely attached in those relationships.
I actually think that's the perfect like depiction of what we're trying to talk about right now.
Mm-hmm.
Is that from the outsider's perspective, right? If you're just taking into consideration attachment theory, which there's a lot of things that are missed and missed marked opportunities there as well in attachment theory. But if we're talking about like, if we're just specifically looking at it from attachment theory perspective, and you're saying, oh, well, Megan's disconnected, Megan's on their own, isolated, whatever, must not be secure attachment. But what I'm hearing from a neurotype perspective and a neurology perspective is very secure if the people on the other side are also understanding, like, mom needs a break, mom needs to read, mom needs to self-soothe, mom loves us and is in a different room. Like, that takes into account the sensory needs, which I think is where we're trying to create that much more complex picture here.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's where, like, I would love to see attachment theory kind of adapted for neurodivergent folks of, like, what are the kind of the markers? Because I think, like, most things, you'd have to go more into the subjective experience and less on, and rely less on those behavioral markers.
Right. And I think that's so important to make a notation of, too, is to create some evolutionary language and vantage points on terms of how we view attachment theory for neurodivergent folks. Mm-hmm. Because if our neurotypes are different, if we're talking cross neurotype relationships, if we're talking about, you know, a neurotypical parent and a neurodivergent kiddo or vice versa, or partnership, there's going to be all of these new almost like things and what's the word I'm looking for? There's going to have to be new ways to really, I don't want to use the word adapt. That's not the right word. To become more comfortable within relationships, mm-hmm. understanding that not every single relationship is going to look like this, you know, textbook definition of what one mm-hmm. needs to look like.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think for both partners and parents who aren't also specifically autistic, understanding, because I'm sure you see this a lot, right? In cross neurotype partnerships where, you know, one person's need for space, like that can activate a whole story for the other partner of like, this person's pulling away from me. Yep. I lost the thought. There was a thought, but it flew away.
It's probably because I took so long in that convoluted way of saying what I was saying.
I think it's all my brain there.
You're right, though. I mean, and I think like if we're talking about, okay, this person needs space, this is what their sensory system needs is space. Mm-hmm. But their attachment system doesn't need space. Like in mm-hmm. their embodied experience, this is actually like the safest place for them is to have that mm-hmm. space, because that means they feel very connected to you to be able to take that space. But then you have someone who might be on the anxious, insecure side where it's like, whoa, this person's pulling away. They don't love me anymore. They don't care about mm-hmm. me. Let me come closer. And then odds are you back even further away. And it creates that anxious avoidant.
Yes. What is it called? See, these are the things. Brain fog is so interesting. Like things I used to be able to pull into mind. Dance something pattern. It comes from EFT. The pursuit, distance, or dynamic. Is a kind of a classic because here's the interesting thing. When you're insecurely attached, you're actually more likely to partner with someone who's also insecurely attached, but from the other side of the road. So like if you're avoidant, you might partner with an anxiously attached, vice versa, which then of course there's going to be like some messy dynamics that show up. So that distance or pursuer is what's talked about of like, there's the pursuer, because for we haven't talked a whole lot about kind of anxious attachment, but for anxious attachment, when there's an attachment kind of insecurity, they need closure, like they need to work it through with the person. The avoidant person needs space to regulate to be able to come back to that conversation, but that can create the pursuers coming closer because that's what their attachment needs to downregulate. The avoidant person's distancing because that's what they need space to downregulate. So then the pursuer distance or dynamic, because it, yeah.
And around we go. Mm-hmm.
And around we go. Yeah. Yeah. I'm married to someone who's securely attached, but like introverted and does really well with alone time. And I realized the reason all my other relationships didn't work before I met Luke was they weren't as independent. And so at some point, my relationships always made a turn where they started feeling really intrusive and really not good. And so that's been interesting. Typically, too, like avoidant people don't get together romantically. But I wouldn't say Luke and I are truly avoidant, but we're very independent. And that's not it's not a classic pairing you see a lot. But I realized like I absolutely needed someone like that. Like I wouldn't work with someone who wasn't also had like high need for independence and were separations okay.
I think that's a good point. And it's good to know what you both need, and then to be able to find it is I wouldn't say it's a rarity, because it's certainly not, but it does take a lot of like introspection and discussion and communication about needs too, and then each partner being confident in their ability to offer that and offer themselves what they need. I think that's equally as important, like knowing what you've mentioned this before when we're talking about partnerships, but like just the fact that partnerships, you should not always be solely reliant on your partner for joy, happiness, contentment, relational like connection. Like you've got to get that elsewhere too. Mm-hmm. And I think you have to have the confidence in both of yourselves and each other to be able to have that space to also have your own interests, to also have your own friendships, to also have your own like downtime where every single second doesn't have to be interwoven. What are you thinking about that?
I was just thinking about how helpful it would be, like, you know, when people are making life partnerships, like, they know about things like attachment style and neurotype and like how these things overlay, and like just think about how helpful all these lenses are, and how like rarely, I think the younger generation, they're getting there, but how rarely we enter into these partnerships with these lenses that I think can really unlock so much understanding and alleviate a lot of pain.
For sure. For sure. I don't even think I knew the word attachment until I was like 26, 27. Mm-hmm. You know, I really didn't know much about my own neurodivergence at that time, if any at all. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, through partnerships, like doing a lot of trying to figure out like what's working, what's not working. Why are certain relationships typically ending? What am I missing up front, or vice versa? And I think for like my marriage, you know, we're going on 10 years of being married at this point in time. A lot of it at first was doing that dance of like that anxious avoidant like situation. And I would say my wife is way less avoidant or anxious, probably more secure than a lot of folks. But ultimately, when I would push away because I needed to push away and I didn't know why I needed space, or I didn't know why I needed to isolate or disconnect, she wouldn't go anywhere. And I think that created that feeling of safety of like, now I can start verbalizing like, this is what I need. This is why I need it. It has nothing to do with you. I just am realizing like, I need a lot of time to be alone and to be autonomous and to be independent.
I love that. I love she didn't go anywhere. That's a secure base, right? Like,
exactly.
She stayed secure. She was there. She wasn't punishing. Like when you came back, it wasn't, and you need to be punished before we can reunite.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if this relates. I'm curious. So yeah, dating, I dated a bit. I'd hit a part like where it started feeling intrusive, and I'd get, oh, this sounds really bad. I'm going to have a vulnerability hangover after this episode, Patrick. I understand it, but when it started to feel intrusive, I would get grossed out by my partners. And once it turned, it was really hard to unturn it. I now realize, I think it was kind of a sensory, like, you know, I have misophonia. So like I joke with my spouse of like, I just won't be in the same room when he's eating cereal. Like, cause I will forever be like grossed out by him, and it'll linger for a while. But it would do this thing where it would turn in my relationships and I wouldn't be able to recover. And I think it was kind of a sensory grossed out meets intrusion. And I couldn't then like recover from that feeling of intrusion. So I definitely had a point of like, am I ever going to find a long-term partner? Is marriage ever going to work for me? Or am I always going to have this experience of it turning? And then, right, all or nothing, like it, once it's ruined, it's ruined. Was dating hard for you?
Yeah. So I'm actually glad you named that. So I had similar experiences where like, if I was dating, I was really, I wouldn't use the word infatuated, but I was definitely much more excited about the relationship and the person at first. And then
high infatuation early.
High infatuation. Yep. Yeah. So totally. Like, And you probably then come across like more charismatic, and you come across like more interesting.
Well, special interest energy, right? Like special interest energy plus new like romance energy. Like, oh my gosh, it is a powerful combo.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So this is, again, another example of where we could say attachment or neurotype or neurology, right? Or the combination of the two. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people who are attachment therapists, oriented therapists, would say like the avoidance style, that's very typical where like you would get really infatuated, you'd be really excited, and then you'd start to pull away. You'd start to find little things about your partner that make you no longer feel connected to them so that you could have your autonomy and your freedom and your independence and you could no longer be connected. But if we were framing it from the neurodivergent perspective that you are mentioning, like the sensory component and the intrusiveness and the feelings of like, oh, my body no longer feels safe. It no longer feels like excited and no longer feels secure in this. That's exactly what I think is missing from a lot of this literature. Mm-hmm. Too.
And that's where, to return to what I was saying earlier, which I can now revisit without so much emotion. Like, I think that's where fantasy, I think a lot of us spend a bit of time in fantasy. And I think like that's where fantasy of an ideal relationship or an ideal person, especially in that early infatuation period, becomes so seductive because in fantasy, we aren't sensory creatures. In fantasy, we don't have that turn, like that turn when there's a sensory unpleasant experience. And I think that can make relationships hard, right? Like we're infatuated. Many of us might be fantasizing. Okay, I'll speak from my experience. I'd get super special interest energy, so curious about the person. I think the person would typically like my curiosity and my interest felt, I don't have the word, but then I would do a lot of fantasizing and idealizing and building it up. No relationship can live up to that. No reality can live up to that. Yeah.
And then when it doesn't, and you're no longer in that special interest energy, and maybe your sensory system is being more activated because of some sort of partnership or relationship, and then all of a sudden the pendulum swings almost the complete opposite way. And I wonder, even like we're talking a lot about this from an autistic perspective, which I feel like we tend to frame most of this podcast from, but I wonder about the ADHD type too, where stimulation and, you know, really,
oh my gosh, yeah, that absolutely factor,
right? And like, yeah,
no, that's a huge, like, okay, I'm gonna do a little detour. I was talking with some of my children, and I could just tell their affect was a little bit different. I was like, are you sad? And they were like, no. And then they were like, I feel sad, but I don't know why. And then I looked and I was like, are you understimulated? And their eyes opened up and they're like, yes, I'm understimulated. And I've started noticing, you know, I've been married 15 years, that like times when I have like started to feel discontent in my marriage, and I just think everyone experiences seasons of that if you're married for a long time, what I realized is like, oh, I was understimulated. And that lens of understimulation has been really helpful. Like, I'm not discontent with my spouse. I'm like experiencing understimulation. Okay, I need an infusion of creativity or some sort of stimulus. But I think that happens a lot for ADHDers, is once they once the relationship's not as stimulating, it can be tempting to let me go look for that elsewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with that 100%. So, you know, stimulation seeking, right? And then when we have that dopamine, when we have that adrenaline rush, when we have all the feel-good chemicals in our body, and then all of a sudden it's like, well, that same person, that relationship's not create, there's the stimulation's missing. So it must be something wrong with the relationship.
And right Right.
How often can you be in partnership where it's stimulating 100% of the time? Mm-hmm. I don't think that's possible.
Right. But I think when our 80, like, especially if we don't understand our like need for stimulus. Yeah, exactly that. It's so easy to go that narrative of like, there must be something wrong here.
Right.
So this, okay, kind of a rabbit trail, but also I think important because so we're both, as far as I know from you, Patrick, we're both in monogamous arranged partnerships. A lot of neurodivergent people are polyamorous or so have different structures. And I think this is perhaps one of the reasons, especially for autistic ADHDers, like if you have a frame that supports that, I see why that works for a lot of people, because you get the new relationship energy and you have the secure base when well done, right? When there's a lot of good intentional conversations and the framework around it is set up well. I thought about that of like, yeah, that makes sense why that works well for so many folks.
Yeah, I think that makes perfect sense in a lot of ways. I think that's why my marriage works really well, even though it is a monogamous one. It's non-traditional in a sense where people will look at the fact that we spend a lot of time apart from one another and say, like, mm-hmm. is everything okay at home?
Yep.
I see that Patrick's traveling by himself all the time and you're never with him. Or she like has so many friend groups and so many book clubs and so many things that she's involved in. And I don't often go to those things or to those events or to those parties mm-hmm. or to any of those things. So there is this like level of autonomy and independence and almost separateness within the marriage mm-hmm. and relationship, despite like neither one of us very often feeling disconnected from each mm-hmm. other.
That like, yeah, I'm smiling so big right now because like, yeah, that's my marriage and that's why it works. Does it work for Ariel?
Yeah, for Ariel, it works. I think there are definitely times she would prefer that I would definitely come to a get together or a party, or like I could at times be more spontaneous with my answers instead of mm-hmm. 9 times out of 10 being like, no, I don't want to do that. But I think it does work for this stage of our lives. I think the first couple of years, it was challenging for her to be mm-hmm. like, what the fuck is going on? Like,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
My husband doesn't want to come to anything with me.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. And it's interesting. As soon as I asked that, I'm like, oh, of course it works for Luke. But Luke is also my spouse. I might have him listen to this before we air it, just to make sure, you know, he's cool with everything. He's a very, very like intense people pleaser. So I also realized like, and one thing I've been encouraging him to do, again, this might sound controversial. I've been telling him like, hey, I both celebrate and grieve my like autism diagnosis. You get to do that too, because like it impacts our relationship. And he's started slowly, like, you know, there's a concert in town that he was like, oh, yeah, I did have this on of like, it'd be nice to like go to that with you, and I know that wouldn't happen, or that if we did that would be really hard for you. And I'm encouraging him to explore his grief around this. So I'm also realizing that I do think it mostly works for us, but also that there can be grief for the spouse. And I think it's so important we let our spouses experience that without it feeling like that's ableism. That's just part of the complexity of human relationship and emotion.
Yeah. And you've actually mentioned that exact scenario on here a couple of times now. And I think it's important, like it's not only important, it's like paramount to be mm-hmm. able to really help support your spouse have their own emotional journey within partnership about what their experience is like. Because I'm sure there are times where Ariel's like, man, I'm going to this thing tonight and there's going to be a lot of people there. And I might be one of the only partnered people mm-hmm. that is there solo. Mm-hmm. And that can feel like, you know, there's something wrong on the home front. when mm-hmm. I'm traveling all over the damn world by myself, and people are always like, oh, are you married? Do you have a partner? Like, where are they? Like, do they come with you on these events? I'm like, yeah, they do. They have 4 weeks of time off and I don't. And mm-hmm. like, they hate traveling. So this is just the balance that we have found that works for both of us. And I think mm-hmm. it gives me that stimulation and that sensation seeking that I need and that freedom. And it also, it just works. So I do think finding out what works is important. Like you said before, have we had known this earlier on in our lives, it would probably save ourselves, our partners, our friends a lot of pain. But I'm glad to have arrived to it now and mm-hmm. before it was too late to do that.
Mm-hmm. I think what I'm feeling like just a lot of gratitude that we both found people that like, because I think for both of us, it takes kind of unique people to be able to be married to us.
Yeah. Yes.
And I'm really glad we both found people for whom we've been able to build a life that's secure and also like works with our sensory needs and our, and I think sounds like works for our partner's needs as well, mostly.
For sure. I like the mostly caveat because that's probably the case.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to like be, yeah, it totally works for, I'm sure it, yeah, mostly.
This will be a good episode to then have both of them on here, like we talked
about. We've talked about that. We have talked about having, yeah, do you want to do like a four-way conversation?
I think it would be pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, goodness. I think that would be really interesting. Yeah, I'll try to see if Luke's up for that.
No pressure. But yeah, I think, again, as so many of these conversations are, there is so much nuance and complexity here. And it's not just attachment style. It's not just neurotype or neurology. It's everything. And I think we have to assess and look at everything when we are trying to figure out not only our clients', you know, struggle areas in terms of their relational relationships and their attunement, but our own and our friendships and our partnerships with our families, etc., and really taking neurodiversity into account and consideration when we are looking at relational dynamics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Other thoughts?
This is our I don't feel like I have anything to add to that, or kind of feel like we're at our awkward goodbye time.
I like that it started awkward. We both were kind of foggy. We both were kind of cloudy. And then it developed into what I think was a really good, powerful conversation. Mm-hmm. And I'm just grateful for you too, in terms of if we're looking at attachment and in friendships, because we haven't seen each other in a couple weeks and mm-hmm. we're both not feeling great, but I'm pretty happy with how that turned out.
Yeah, same.
All right, everyone who's listening. So Divergent Conversations is out every single Friday on all major platforms and YouTube. You can follow us on Instagram as well. Like, download, subscribe, and share. And goodbye.